Subcommittee on Ways and Means, Subcommittee on Human Services, Tuesday, April 24th, 2001, public hearing 5527, Department of Human Services, and we are having an overview of the health division, and with me this morning is Grant Higginson and Dave Fazer from DAS, and I got it correct this morning, it's Dave, Mike, not Dave, oh, this is Dave, okay. And we have all the chronologically advantaged members are present. They are all present this morning. And we have one of our juniors is present this morning.
We just have, we're tired of parents and everything.
Yeah, this is right. Exactly in all the water. Welcome.
Good morning, Chair Winters and members of the committee. Again, for the record, my name is Dr. Grant Higginson, and I am the acting administrator for the Oregon Health Division Department of Human Services. And what I thought I would do today is start out by giving you a few things that you had requested yesterday. There were a number of questions that came from the committee. We have not been able to respond to all of them, but there were some things we could do quickly and some things we thought were important to get back to you right away on. The rest will be coming hopefully by the end of the week. The first thing is that Senator Yee yesterday asked if we could get the information that we had gotten to her on outreach to prenatal patients and fetal alcohol syndrome, as well as information on teen pregnancy prevention, and there should be a package of those materials in front of you. Another thing that you had asked for were policies around leave and overtime, and there should be a package of those materials that include things from Department of Administrative Services as well as from the Health Division.
I think this is in conjunction with the question from the audit report, and the audit report was conducted prior or after this date of these policies, you know? Because the date of this policy is effective 2/15/99.
Madam Chair, the date of the audit, the date of the audit report was 2000, and I'm trying to recall the month. Looks like the day of the audit report is October 23rd, 2000.
Yeah, so these policies were in effect.
Yeah, I had heard that this morning, too.
And I believe that there are a few policies there. One of them dealing with accumulation of vacation leave and when a person can actually be compensated with money for that. There's one from the Health Division dealing with discretionary leave policy, and then there is another piece dealing with overtime, which I believe is straight from or related to the contract.
To the contract?
Yeah, that we have with the union.
I think that the what was flagged in the audit report was where you had administrators who had left and they had received undue compensation in their departure, and I think that that was not only your agency, but there was a couple of other agencies that had been mentioned in the report, and so not the, your management labor contract.
Okay. Okay. And understood, and that issue I believe has been dealt with by the department. That was a department level issue rather than a Health Division issue.
Madam Chair, for the record, Dave Fazer from Department of Administrative Services, Budget Management Division. I did want to draw the subcommittee's attention to the handout that is State Policy 60.000.05 Vacation Leave. And on the second page, you should have some yellow highlights. It says up at the top, State of Oregon, Department of Administrative Services, Human Resource Service Division. Could be stapled together, two pages.
I'm not sure where my... We're looking... You're down at the bottom there. Okay.
On the second page, you'll see some highlight down in the lower part, section 6, accumulation of vacation leave. A, B, and, I'm sorry, subparagraphs A and B there are the revised policy directly in response to the findings of the audit in October. These changes were made by the Department of Administrative Services specifically to clarify policy related to activities that result in the findings that we were discussing yesterday in the audit. I just wanted to highlight that for the subcommittee. Thank you.
Madam Chair?
Dave,
I've often wondered, you know, our LFO staff, and I'm sure you do too during this session, work Saturdays and Sundays, 10, 12 hours a day, most days. Is there a cap on the amount of the, do they get compensatory time or accumulated vacation time, or how does that work?
Madam Chair, Senator Hartung, for management service folk, such as myself, there are discretionary leave that is given sometimes at the end of a session or budget buildup, but there
That's
is no
with pay discretionary leave.
It is,
yeah,
with pay. However, most of the time, that's just an attempt to compensate for a lot of the overtime, yeah, that we do. We are not on a compensatory time system whatsoever. So
okay.
We work at your pleasure, and we work very, very diligently.
I know it's a pleasure.
I think that's a good question and that response, because
yeah,
I don't think that the public knows that you are working at the pleasure, and that it is discretion. You know, you do get some discretionary time, and that your contract is not the same as the contract for classified and non-executive appointees. And so
I'm curious, David. Under the, and I forget what the, and I know him well too, the court case on
yeah,
management service people, would you folks have been eligible for overtime pay?
Madam Chair, Senator Duncan, yes, management service for a specific amount of time, depending on where they work, were eligible to apply for that overtime.
I want to take the opportunity here on record to really applaud those state employees that
yeah,
who did not file for the benefits under the Young case. And I don't, you know, and I've wanted the media, often state employees and management get tagged in a negative way. And there were thousands of individuals who did not avail themselves of that loophole.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to applaud those individuals because they could have based on the court case, and they did not. And so I think sometimes the public doesn't talk about the good that's done in these buildings and the employees who really are dedicated public servants. So just for the record.
Amen.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yes, Madam Chair, I appreciate that very much. And then the last set of information, the materials that we've given to you, was in response to the question about getting further breakdown on the positions and FTEs within each of the centers. And there's two things that I'd like you to take a look at. One is a more detailed organizational chart. And there, for each one of the different centers, we have the positions in the actual sections as well. It's still not broken down into the specific program areas, but at least that gives you a better idea of how things are spread across the division. And then the other thing that I would like you to take a look at is this spreadsheet that actually goes into then the FTEs by program level. So that you can see, for instance, that top one for disease prevention and epidemiology in 1999-01 administration had four. In 2001-03. There's still four in administration. And one thing that I would point out is looking at the totals by center, you can see that for disease prevention and epidemiology, there was an increase in a total dollar amount of around $8 million, $7 to $8 million, and an increase in the FTEs of 6. And that is all through the $7 million tobacco prevention education money that is in the governor's recommended budget. And if you look at the totals for all of the other centers, you'll see that basically they have stayed the same. And then the other thing that I would like to point out on this is if you look at the back side, the very bottom on the 2001-03 budget, you'll see that out of the total budget of $323 million, that over $200 million of those dollars is going out in special payments. And yesterday there was a question asked about whether or not the division could do more with passing money through rather than using it at the state level. And I just wanted to point out that basically two-thirds of all the money that comes to the health division does go out in the way of special payments. Primarily that's to local health departments, but tribes, community-based organizations, and other people get those dollars as well. And then while I didn't provide any materials on this, there were a couple of issues that came up yesterday that I did want to respond to. And, actually, I think I'll do that at the end because they really came from Representative Bates and Schrader, so I'd like to wait until they're back. So what we're going to do then is get restarted on the factors affecting services, and we were into the middle of that, and we're on page 27. Where we're talking about the implementation of the 1996 Federal Safe Drinking Water Act, where the EPA has adopted 9 major new regulations since 1996, and we're scheduled to adopt 6 new ones by 2002. And we have a special agreement with EPA called Primacy, where we're actually in very much control of the drinking water system programs, and we have to make sure at the state level that we're complying with all of those regulations. We have an advisory board that we work with in order to come up with the priorities that we are going to follow in achieving the maximum public health benefits within our existing resources. The governor's recommended budget for the drinking water program does allocate 24.5 FTE for these primacy functions during 2001-03, and that is the same staffing level as the past biennium. And one point we wanted to make here was that we are being asked to do more work with the same resources. We've talked about HIPAA briefly before, but there's going to be new HIPAA rules and regulations that are going to apply to us and lots of other people, and that needs to be considered across all data systems development for our programs and populations that we serve.
Grant, are they providing you additional funds?
Chair Winters, for HIPAA?
Mm-hmm.
Chair Winters and members of the committee, no, they are not. And these are major new requirements that we are being told make Y2K pale in comparison, and we have people at both the division level and the department level that are working hard on this to figure out how we're going to make that happen.
Because I think those are, what, 90-10 funds, if they do provide them with this.
The maternal and child health block grant is something that is allocated annually to us from the Department of Health and Human Services. That continues to be flat funded. The grant does require a 4-3 state match and requires that 30% of the services be used for children with special health care needs. Actually, that goes directly from us to the OHSU Child Development and Rehabilitation Center. Requires 30% to be services provided to children, and then the rest can be used for women issues. We receive a number of small categorical grants from federal and private foundations, and we've used these to complement the ongoing federal allocations and state general funds that we have in order to achieve the outcomes that we're trying to achieve with our existing funding streams. And this issue of trying to plug in the holes in areas is an issue that crosses all of our centers. And this is an issue that we started talking about some yesterday, about how using those grants to try to plug those holes and to try to have a more comprehensive coordinated program actually sometimes leads to decreased flexibility and increased complexity because of the categorical nature of those grants. Fund support for health-related services for children, infants, and pregnant women with special health care needs through the counties are provided, that we provide are not those that are reimbursable through third-party payers or through Medicaid. And again, the greatest challenge is for us to maintain that 4-3 match because the availability of state general funds are being reduced or at least held flat at the state level. And we do rely on local health departments to be providing a lot of the match dollars in order for us to comply with that 4-3 match.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Hartung.
Grant, where do the local health departments get most of their funds?
Chair Winter, Senator Hartung, I don't have that breakdown in front of me, but in general, it's about a third of the funding in total. And, you know, it depends on the county, but in looking statewide, about a third of the funding in total comes from money that comes through the state health division. Another third of their dollars comes from fees that they generate at the local level through their programs. And then the other third comes from county general fund.
County
general fund.
There is no direct federal funding to the local health.
Chair Winter, Senator Hartung, in general, there is not. You know, most of the federal funding for public health activities comes through the health division. There are a few cases, and I believe Multnomah County has a couple of grants where they do get federal funds directly. But by and large, the federal government works with counties through the state government rather than directly.
Thank you, Mr.
Is it possible for us to get just a spreadsheet of the dollars that the counties receive, the one-third, 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 and it may vary county by county?
Chair Winters, we will get you that information.
Thank you.
Childhood immunization schedules continue to grow both in terms of the vaccines that are recommended and the complexity of the schedule. And just for an example, hepatitis A vaccine was added in 1999 and pneumococcal conjugate vaccine in the year 2000. We know that down the line there's going to be combination vaccines like hepatitis A, hepatitis B, and the point here is that immunization schedules and the ages of the populations that are being addressed are always changing, and that is a complicating factor in the way we provide services. Immunization is a high priority for the health division, and we have taken steps to begin planning process for the next pandemic. I'm not sure if people are aware of this, but every so often the earth, really the earth is hit with major flu pandemics. The last big one was in 1968, where people were calling the Asian flu. The last really big one that caused a whole lot of deaths across the world was in the early 1900s. Anyway, we're gearing up because we know that sooner or later, and it's very possibly in the next decade, that we are going to be hit with a pandemic. And so we are working with a number of work groups to address the problems that we see would be presented. We're developing a control plan that's going to be closely linked with some bioterrorism planning that we're doing right now. The division has been an active partner in Senate Bill 555, community planning effort, and that is one that's developing early childhood systems. One of the main responsibilities we have there is for the development of a childhood data system for early childhood issues. The division is also a partner in teen pregnancy efforts and adolescent mental health and school health efforts with other state agencies. And those last two issues were just to point out that in looking at how we provide services, coordination with other agencies is critically important to us.
Thank you. Representative Carlson.
Moving back to the 555, I asked you a question about that yesterday, and I know that when the juvenile crime prevention plan was being rolled out, Health Division played a pretty big role in assisting counties in understanding how to interpret data, how to use trend data, that type of thing, and I know that that's something that you do well, and the counties are actually trying to deal with looking at data and using data as a basis to create strategies. Can you see the Health Division as perhaps playing that role in a broader role in Senate Bill 555 planning?
Chair Winters, Representative Carlson, yes, we do. And the data system piece is one part of that, but just the whole idea of using data is something that's important to us. We have a unit in the disease prevention epidemiology section called the info unit. That is their job, to try to get that information out. We've really tried to use the web technologies to a great extent, and see that as a real boon to people being able to access those data. But I think there's going to need to continue to be some one-on-one or small group work at the local level as well. And then just the final thing I'd like to add on the factors affecting services, that the rapidly changing demographics have led the state and the Health Division to recognize the need for culturally competent services and a more diverse and multicultural workforce. These areas are critical to the state's ability to provide adequate public health services and to work towards eliminating health disparities in Oregon, and that is something that we are clearly committed to. The next page then is just a pie chart.
Let's go back to that for a little bit, because I understand, I do know that Senator Gordley has a proposed legislation that was an outcome of the racial and ethnic task force that was convened in the interim. And, you know, I personally always get bothered when we have to set up something because an agency has not gone ahead and dealt with those issues in the first instance. So we end up setting up another group of something to study what we already should be about. And the proposal is to add some data collection functioning within the Health Division. And my question is, can you do that without adding additional staff or the need for additional resources?
Chair Winters, this is an issue that we actually have been involved with and concerned about for a number of years. I think it was about 10 years ago our then-administrator Mike Skeel set up the Office of, then it was called Minority Health, which has later changed into Multicultural Health, that's been trying to look at these issues. The reason the Multicultural Health the Race and Ethnic Health Task Force was set up was because of some recognition at the federal level as well as the state level that there continues to be, despite work done at all levels of government, there continues to be some major disparities in a number of health outcomes. And one of the Racial and Ethnic Health Task Force, during their deliberations over the interim, did come up with a number of recommendations. One of those recommendations was trying to come up with better data, because we in Oregon in particular, because we have a relatively small population of minority populations, it is difficult to get really good data to be planning those interventions and strategies. So my understanding is that $500,000 has been proposed in the governor's budget to help support the recommendations of the Racial and Ethnic Health Task Force. About $180,000 of those dollars are going to be used for improved data collection, and that would be not only enhancements of what we currently do, but actually new projects as well. About $180,000 would be used for special projects to reduce health disparities out in local communities, and then $140,000 would be to have somebody that would help shepherd on the recommendations of the Race and Ethnic Task Force within the Office of Multicultural Health. And I've just been handed something that for the data collection FTE, so it's about $180,000, and that would be two FTEs. And then the other thing is that one of the bills that Senator Gordley proposed and has been heard on the Senate side is a bill that would move the Office of Multicultural Health out of the Health Division. And actually, it was first proposed that it would go to the Governor's Office. I think what is now being proposed is that it would go to the Director's Office in the Department of Human Services.
What's the genesis behind not wanting to keep it in the Health?
Chair Winters, my understanding is that the task force felt that to elevate the office to a higher level than even the Health Division, and to put it in either the Governor's Office or the Director's Office would give it a level of credibility that it does not have now. Credibility and attention.
I guess my question then becomes, will we take each time there is an issue that has to do with cultural competency or whatever, we take it out of the agency and elevate it? That's just a side comment.
Right. And Chair Winters, actually, that point is something that I share with you, too. I mean, there's pros and cons in doing that. One is that I do think that the higher up that you get it, the more visibility and the closer you have to the ear of the people who are making the final decisions. On the other hand, the higher you get it up, the less direct contact they have with the individual programs that are going to have the most effect in making the actual changes. I mean, that's an issue that we face at the Health Division as well. But I do know that we at the Health Division have a commitment to supporting the recommendations of the task force, regardless of where that is, and have started some things in process to make sure that does happen. So we're now on page 30, where we're looking at the pie chart breakdown of the 0103 governor's recommended budget by fund source. And again, as I've mentioned a number of times already, general fund is about 8% of our total funds. Other funds, which is primarily fee collection, but some other issues as well, makes up 20%. Strict federal funds make up 40% of our budget. And then for the WIC food vouchers, that makes up 32% of our budget. And within that WIC foods, the bulk of that, again, is federal funds. About three-quarters of it is federal funds. And then another quarter is considered other funds because it comes through a rebate that we get. On the next page is the governor's recommended budget by expenditures, by activity. And here you can see that it's broken down into about a third. There's a small amount, 4% used for division-wide administration, but then program and direct state services is 33%. WIC food vouchers, again, count for 32%. And then special payments to local agencies is just about a third, 31% of our budget. And then on the next page is the governor's recommended budget expenditures by program unit. And I don't think I can, I'll go through all of this, but just to say that, again, WIC takes up about a third of the budget. The two biggest centers in the way of budget are disease prevention and epidemiology, which is 24% of the budget, and child and family health, which is 28%.
Madam Chair.
Senator Steele.
Grant, looking at that particular pie chart, I know that you don't make an equation, and there can't be an equation that says something like, you know, cuts could equal public health risk, because there's no direct equation. But at some point, when we make some cuts that could affect the public health laboratory or disease prevention, epidemiology, those parts of this pie chart, at some point, it would occur to me that there could be a greater public health risk because a cut is made here or a little cut is made there, and it makes it harder for maybe the health lab to do its job or to do screening or whatever. Are you able to calculate in any way some of the maybe unintended consequences of a cut here or a cut there?
Chair Winter, Senator Shields, I mean, it is a very difficult thing to do. I'm not sure I can give you a better answer than that. And, I mean, just when we go through our budget-cutting exercises that we have to do with every budget cycle, you know, we try to look at those things and try to balance one against the other. And it is simply a very difficult thing to do. You know, is providing less home visiting services less or more important than communicable disease testing at the lab? You know, they oftentimes they're such apples and oranges considerations that it is difficult to make those choices.
It's my comment, Madam Chair, that this is a tough area because you get a lot of mileage out of public health dollars, and public's health could be adversely affected if we're not careful.
Senator Shields, I think that no matter which agency that we talk to that has to do with the human needs, that same question would apply. And and of course the other piece of it is that, and I agree with Grant, unless we have this big crystal ball or we become sorcerers, and I know that doesn't fit within your collar, that looking so far ahead to know what those pitfalls and what would happen, agencies have a real difficult time, I think, in putting together a 2-year budget, let alone looking, you know, beyond. And so I kind of think that they're giving us their best judgment based on their historical perspective, and add that to the chronologically advantaged perspective that sits up here on this panel, and you know, and our new experience from our doctor here too, that we're all just kind of given our best shot with what we have to work with.
Just a point to make this morning.
I understand.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome.
Yeah, the next graph is a bar graph showing our budget compared, current governor's recommended budget compared to the last session's budget. And what's not on the page is the total dollar figures. In 1999-01 budget, we had a total of $307 million, and for 01-03, $323 million. And if you take a look at the different bar charts, you can see that basically the increase is almost all accounted for by an increase in federal funds. And as I've mentioned before, we aggressively seek out federal funds for public health purposes. The other thing that I think is interesting in this bar graph is the fact that there's actually a decrease in the governor's recommended budget in the amount of general funds this session, and that accounts for about just under $4 million reduction. The next section is dealing with administrative costs, and the Health Division's administration sets overall policy and management direction, provides statewide direction for public health, including staff support.
Grant, do you have any information in here that shows us either the growth or the decline in revenue for the Oregon Health Division over the past, say, 10 years?
Chair Winters, we do not, but that is something, again, we can get you. And, I mean, basically, I can tell you that federal funds has been where we have seen the biggest increase over the last decade. That state general funds has been, you know, proportionately a smaller and smaller piece. When I first came to the Health Division 14 years ago, we were about 20% general. State general funded. And then I think there have been a couple of other times when general fund dollars actually decreased between sessions, but we will get you that information.
Could some of that shift have been, I know that at one time in this building that the programs that we funded or the policies that we funded were those policies that were driven by the legislative body and the state and not by the federal government. I think it was actually pretty much by the panel who sat on this side, there was real scrutiny on whether or not you would even apply for federal funds to make sure that those programs mirrored the policy of the state. So when I'm looking at all this federal growth, you know, I have to ask myself the question, who's driving the state anymore?
Chair Winters, that's a good question.
Do you remember that?
Another thing that we do is provide statewide direction for public health, including staff support to such groups as Public Health Advisory Board, Conference of Local Health Officials, and I mentioned the Racial and Ethnic Health Task Force. We also provided staff support for that as well during the last interim. Prepare the division's budgets that we're reviewing right now. We coordinate communications and external relations for the division by assuring timely, accurate health information is provided to both the public and other governmental agencies and to policymakers. We provide planning, strategy, and linkage to partners. We monitor the division's efforts towards achieving the Oregon benchmarks and other performance measures. We coordinate legislative information and activities. We coordinate opportunities for community partners to participate in health education via distance learning. And this is an area that we're hoping to expand upon in the future, and there's some wonderful technologies coming out to do so. We also coordinate department-wide central support services through directly managing the mailroom and stockroom services, but then also providing liaison function with the business services, information systems, human resources, organizational development that's actually provided by the department centrally. And then this next section is what we were asked to do, to take a look at the historical and current ratios of administration to other services. And just looking at the bar chart, I think it's clear that things have stayed pretty much the same. And if you look at the numbers, they have stayed pretty much the same as well. What the different numbers represent, for instance, on the governor's recommended budget, 0103, there's a program and direct services ratio of 11.39%, and then a division-wide without WIC for 5.47. Actually, both of those figures do not include WIC, because if you include WIC, it skews things. But what basically those are is that the program and direct services are not taking into account the special payments portion of the budget, and then the one that has the lower percentage is actually does include the special payments contribution. And actually I think that lower figure is the one that's more appropriate, because we do provide administrative support for the special payments that go out.
How much will your administrative activities change under the reorg?
That is something that's actually being looked at right now. We have a team of people from the director's office, and then some of our own staff that's right now looking at all of the administrative services and how things are going to be centralized. You know, already the department has a number of those functions centralized, so I'm not sure how big of a change it is going to be, but there certainly will be some.
You don't have a regional structure, so that's not.
Does the health division have a regional structure? No, it does not. And then the other thing.
Madam Chair, I know that your administrative cost has increased from 10.83% to 11.39%. What is the reason for increase in administrative costs?
Senator Yee, that is primarily due to the $500,000 that is put in for the Racial and Ethnic Health Task Force. That $500,000 is what primarily accounts for that increase. And in doing the budget, they put all of that $500 into the administrator's office, and so that's why the cost shows up that way. But actually, that very little of that $500,000 will be used for administration, so it really should be just about the same as it has been the last couple of sessions.
Madam Chair.
Go from Senator Duffy.
Which once again gives me an opportunity to mention, we need to define administrative costs someplace along the line, because things are appear to be administrative costs when in fact they are not administrative costs. And we do not define it well, and it gives the appearance that we're just spending money for high-paid administrators, and that's not the reality of it.
I understand that there's going to be some technical tweaking and adjustment of this particular issue, and also I think in about a week or so we will have the department in to talk about the reorg, so some of these figures will be subject to change as a result of some conversations.
Okay, I guess my concern really is throughout state government.
Yeah, I think we made a note to talk to DAS, and I'll make a note.
I would hope during the interim somebody could really tackle that issue, because it creates more problem in this assembly and generally to the perception that people have. And I've lived with it for 40 years, and it's never been resolved. I guess I'd like to see it done.
Senator Yee.
Well, I have two questions. One is follow up on what my colleague said. I think that we have this question on definition of administrative costs for as long as I was here, and that's a long time. So why don't we ask for a definition before the end of session?
Yeah.
Instead of going into the interim and the interim, I think before we come to final adoption of budget, let's hear a definition of what administrative cost is.
I have a note to pursue that.
Yes. And I have another question, which is what I wanted to ask yesterday, and you said to me I was ahead of the pages. And my question was back in page 15 and page 16, you have licensing of laboratory licensing, and then you have licensing of healthcare facilities. Can these two licensing units be combined into one, and you can save a lot of administrative costs this way?
Chair Winter, Senator Yee, they possibly could be consolidated, and that is one thing that we're considering, and I'm sure that is one thing that's going to be considered in the department's reorganization, because there are a number of licensing certification functions across the whole department, not just in the health division. The reason that we have not done that in the past is because the licensing function is very different between those two. And on the laboratory side, you really do need to have laboratory technician people to go out and do those licensing inspections and providing technical consultation, et cetera. The other licensing section dealing with healthcare facilities is one that is done by a group made up of primarily nurses who look at the whole gamut of health facilities, and then they'll, you know, talk with and discuss things with the laboratory licensing folks, but they really are two different functions using two different kinds of professionals. And so that is something that we're considering consolidating. I'm not sure that we're actually going to be able to see a lot of savings with that consolidation, but there may be some.
Mm-hmm. Follow up,
Madam Chair. In the advancing e-government, efficiency government, we heard a lot about using high-tech computer knowledge in applying for licensing and using credit card for payment, and that will save a lot of time, applicants' time, as well as department's time. And if you use the same technology or device, I think there's a lot of advantage in sharing the technology and using the same high technology.
And Chair Winter, Senator Yee, we agree, and we're already doing a number of things where we're trying to get business functions done electronically. One of the big things is we have electronic birth certificates now, so that hospitals can send those electronically rather than doing the paperwork. And the whole area of e-business is something that we are looking into and do want to be using in the future.
Well, I guess, Madam Chair, the concern is the less we spend on administration, the more we can spend on programs and services to clients.
Chairman and Senator Yee, I totally agree. And then just the other thing, the last thing on that page is looking at the FTEs. You'll see that there's been a net increase over the from 01, excuse me, from 99-01 to 01-03 of about seven to eight positions. And as I mentioned before, that's primarily to support the new dollars for tobacco education and prevention, should those remain in the governor's recommended budget.
What occurred between 97-99 and 99-01? Because that's where your FTE increase was first.
Yeah,
36. You had almost 26 FTEs.
No. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Bill Coulomb, Budget Manager for the Oregon Health Division. Primarily, the increase in FTE between 97-99 and the 99-01 for FTE has been a phase-in of a part-time business person within business services that supports my office. That accounts for one of them. The total FTE increase between 418 and 454 is primarily driven by federal fund grants that have rolled in over the last 3 years.
That doesn't explain my question.
I'm sorry.
Because you can have a federal grant without having two FTEs. And so I need a better definition of why you went from 418 to 454. Grants alone does not produce an FTE unless you're talking about you've got a whole bunch of different programs. I was a grants manager for Children's Services Division, so I know that grants alone is not the driving factor.
And Chair Winters, if I could suggest maybe when we come back with the trend
of
where the budget has gone, we can also put in
that
things
helpful
around the FTEs as well. Okay, we're now moving into the intergovernmental and interagency programs, but before we go there, I just wanted to mention a couple of things that came up yesterday that I wanted to deal with, and wanted Representative Bates and Representative Schrader to be here when I did that. One of the issues that came up, that and primarily from Representative Schrader, but a number of people mentioned this, was the idea that things at least appear to be fragmented, and could we do more in the way of consolidation? And I just wanted to use the example of the traumatic brain injury grant that was approved yesterday for us to apply by this committee. And if we do indeed get that grant, what will happen to it is that it will be incorporated into the injury prevention and epidemiology section. So it's not going to be like a little standalone project. It will be incorporated into a section where it will have support not only from those managers, but also collegial relationships with other people working on similar activities. We will also make sure that the work of that grant is coordinated with our trauma system, with our vital statistics center, et cetera. The reason, though, that we would consider this a separate program is that it is still, though, going to require this separate reporting to the funding agency. So it can't just become, you know, a part of what we do injury-wise, because it does have a separate reporting requirement that we will have to continue to provide. And it also, because of the ways we get the fund, cannot simply use those funds for other things, even if we thought that there was something more important. So if we decided that really falls in the elderly was an injury issue that was more important than traumatic brain injury, because of the funding streams, we couldn't do it. So my point here is that while things sometimes seem fragmented, we are doing our best to make sure things are consolidated and that they are coordinated. And then the other thing that I wanted to mention was Representative Bates in particular, I think, was raising issues of why is the health division apparently involved in a number of primary care activities. And as I tried to get across yesterday, this really is not our primary function, and we recognize that. And as I said, over the last 10 years, there really has been a policy move to get as much primary care funding out of public health and into the Oregon health plan or into the to the private sector. But one thing I did try to stress yesterday was that there are times when, and again, if you look at the assurance, you know, what we're responsible for in those 10 essential services is this linking to health services and providing them when they're otherwise not available. So our role is really the outreach to get people in and the linking to appropriate health services, and only to be providing those health services, direct primary care services, when they are unavailable or we're the most appropriate person to do them. And prenatal care, I think, is a good example of where almost all of the money now has left the health division and gone into the Oregon health plan. The few dollars that are used, and again, it's primarily to support the private physicians' prenatal care, are for those cases that truly are uncovered for with insurance one way or another. Immunization, on the other hand, is a special circumstance where oftentimes people, providers in the field decide that the health division or the local health department is the best one to provide those services. There are a number of counties, particularly smaller counties, who have decided that their private offices simply cannot afford to purchase and keep that vaccine, and it's better to do that centrally through the local health department, so that's where they refer all of their cases, and that's a community decision to do it that way. And again, you know, our responsibilities in immunization are to try to get the immunizations out to all providers, not just local health departments, and then provide those services when it's most appropriate. And then there's other special considerations. We talked a little bit about family planning and STDs yesterday, where again, for one reason or another, people choose and feel that that's the better place to receive services. So I just wanted to bring those up, that it's not our primary focus, that there are a number of reasons why we need to provide it, and depending on the particular kind of service, you know, the service delivery system out there is different for the primary care service.
Representative,
just a thought on the granting and how you have a lot of categorical funding streams that limit your ability to be flexible. It would seem to that sort of discussion would seem to argue for us to be perhaps more stringent in what grants we approve. In other words, is there a particular problem or area that the public health departments, health division, feels Oregon should be concentrating on at a particular point in time, and what's the risk that the department, through its coordination, which is good to hear, actually ends up dispersion, if you will, of their resources or attention trying to cover lots of different grants, rather than say, hey, you know, for this biennium or the next biennium, we are going to concentrate on, you know, brain injuries as opposed to spinal injuries and that sort of thing. Again, with limited resources, it would make me, as you explained that, I'm going to be thinking, I think, more carefully about randomly approving the grants, quote, because they don't cost us anything, but maybe they do cost us something in terms of diverting your attention from what you consider to be the more important priorities. And I guess it'd be nice to know which centers within the health division have a particular mission, if you will, for this session or the next 4 years. That would help us, I think, be more thoughtful in what we approved or did not approve.
Chairman, as Representative Trader, no, I appreciate that, and we would not be applying for grants unless we saw them as fitting into a priority area, and traumatic brain injury, as an example, the whole area of injury prevention is something that we have been trying to beef up, and while it doesn't give us a lot of flexibility and does have these categorical requirements, having that grant and including, you know, the additional staff and responsibilities and activities around injury does provide a core infrastructure. It helps support a core infrastructure for injury prevention. If you see what I'm saying, even though it's a separate program, you know, we do it really does become a part of that injury prevention and epidemiology section, and so it does help support the whole. But we would not be applying for grants that we see as separate activities that simply do not fit into any of the program areas that we consider to be primary responsibility.
Representative Bates?
I want, Madam Chair, thank you. I'm going to return again to my theme from yesterday, and when I look at public health, I think of keywords as public health. When I look through your organizational chart, I'm still concerned that has been lost to this organization. That you need to basically look back and say, what is our thrust of our programs and where do we want to go? And is there duplication going on? You have a department for acute communicable disease and a separate department for HIV and sexually transmitted disease and tuberculosis. I see a program for lead poisoning surveillance, and I know from another group that the Oregon Health Plan is trying to, and there's a bill out trying to get surveillance of lead poisoning in children from Multnomah County. I see huge overlaps and concerns on my part of what is public health and what is not public health. Breast cancer and cervical cancer, diabetes, arthritis, diet and physical activity. These are things that I don't think of as public health. Certainly they're health issues, no argument there. But they might well be developed in programs for them and dealt with better in the Oregon Health Plan for those that can't afford private health insurance. Commercial insurances programs are using these same types of programs with guidelines for physicians and everyone that is included in those groups. I just don't see that as part of your charter here, and that concerns me. I also see it so much overlap that you don't get the jobs done. I'm concerned you should get done. And Alden and I talked very briefly yesterday about the immunization program, which is clearly a public health issue. Clearly a public health issue. You've got 70 to 80% of the children here vaccinated. Other states completely fund this program, and we don't. We don't make the vaccine, which is horribly expensive, available freely and easily to people out there. If a child in my community wants to get a vaccination, or mother or father want to take them there, they have to go to a 9-to-5 thing certain days of the week. There's nothing available evenings or weekends, nothing available easily and quickly at schools. The vaccine is terribly expensive. Things we should be doing seem to be lost, and I see this thing just spread all over the map here in this program. I'm not really asking for an answer. What I'm thinking is, and asking you to think about doing, is we've got an interim coming up. Maybe it's time to sit down, think outside the box about what's going on in your department, and really focus down on things you can do and should be doing that we're not getting done.
Thank you, Ben. Chair Winters, Representative Bates, I mean, that's not something I can give you a full answer to now, and would really appreciate, you know, working with you and others over the interim. But just to respond to a couple areas on breast and cervical cancer, for instance, I don't think we should be providing treatment. I mean, that's clearly not our responsibility. What I do think is our responsibility, though, is outreach and linkage, and that's exactly what we're doing. We're doing outreach and linkage, including some screening, and then getting people into appropriate healthcare services. Again, we're not to get into an argument that I don't see that anybody else is doing that outreach work. And the lead poisoning, for instance, that is something that we are working very closely with OMAP. But it goes beyond just getting kids who have Oregon Health Plan or Medicaid screened. I mean, it goes beyond that in looking at community activities to help reduce the burden of lead poisoning. But I would be very, very happy and interested in talking to you more about that.
Representative Bates raised an interesting question, and it's a question that I think that this body on this side will need to grapple with, whether it's during the interim, which is probably the best forum for grappling with the question, what is public health and some of those kinds of issues, and is there an overlapping function between what's happening in the health division and the Oregon Health Plan? Kinds of things. That's a valid question. Senator Shields.
Well, I was particularly interested at a point you're talking about areas in which the outreach might go to minority communities that don't often get access in ways that they should, because I think there is an outreach, if not mandate, kind of a moral imperative at that point, because I agree with what Representative Bates is saying generally, but there is a sense in which we have a history of not reaching out to minority communities with the kind of information. And if the health division is the only place that's happening, and we need to continue at least that part of it.
Well, I don't, you know, his question is broader than the minority issue.
It is.
And I think that the state, whether we're talking about the health division or any other entities, have a responsibility to assure that all of its citizens are duly served and are part of the service delivery. Whether one is talking about the African American community, the Hispanic community, the Asian community, you know, of what community that community is should be served. But I think the question that Representative Bates has raised is the question of the overlap, those kinds of issues, and not the specific delivery of service mode. Senator Yee.
Madam Chair, what Representative Bates raised, the question you raised is what I asked yesterday. Instead of looking at performance measures of 40 kinds of measurements, we really would like to see your performance measures concentrate on what the department is achieving to reach your mission and goal. And looking at your mission, it says government public health agency's role is to see that vital elements are in place and the mission is adequately addressed. So I think the mission is really more in prevention, in immunization, in preventing alcohol, drug use, for the teens, tobacco use for the teens, for the pregnant women, and for adults. We want to see those data to see how we have reduced drug use, tobacco use by the teens, by the pregnant women, how well we do in immunization. And if we don't do well compared to other states, maybe some of our resources should be redirected to where it's important, whether it means more money for immunization or more money in tobacco use prevention. But this is where we can make our policy decision by looking at your performance of your past trend and your future goal. But without that, it's very difficult for us to see whether your program is effective or not and whether money is spent efficiently or not. That's why I think to have a performance measure of the important programs that's useful for us to evaluate what you're doing and how we can get better results. So this 8-page performance measures really do not tell us enough. So I think we need to reduce it to some really useful measures that we can use before we make decision on your budget.
And Senator Yee, we will have that ready for you by the end of the week. Mm-hmm. That pared down list of performance measures.
Yes. And when you decide on those primary performance measures, maybe visit with Representative Bates, make sure they will reach your goals and functions of the division.
Moving into interagency and intergovernmental programs, unlike some of the department's agencies that actually have field structures, the health division does not. Most direct public health services are delivered by local health departments, and the local county partnership that we have with between the local health departments and the health division is a key and critical relationship for us. During the 99-01 biennium, the amount of general fund the state gave to general support for public health to local health departments was just over $4 million. And these state support for public health funds are spent on what are called the 5 mandated services. These are in statute. They include parent and child health, communicable diseases, environmental health, health statistics, information, and referral. And actually, that $4 million is a low figure. Actually, when you look at all of these state general fund dollars that go through us to local health departments, it's about $12.6 million, and that's about half of the general fund that we get in total. Local health departments, for instance, sent 140,000 specimens to the lab for testing, and those were tested then at no charge. The health division prepares communicable disease guidelines, and local health departments investigated over 8,000 disease cases in the year 2000.
Representative Carlson has a question.
Oh.
Thank you. The monies that go to county health departments, do they come through you, so it's a pass-through for you, from you to local, to the county?
Chair Carlson, yes, they do.
Okay. And is there any kind of a planning process, or is it just a straight pass-through with no strings attached?
Chair Carlson, there is an annual plan that is submitted by each local health department to the health division, which is then approved. And within that plan, we then send out assurances, which is in essence a contract for each of the program areas that we have that the local health departments are working on.
So would this plan then be considered as part of looking at part of that coordinated comprehensive plan with Senate Bill 555, even though it's not named in the bill specifically? Are you moving in that direction?
Right. And Cheryl Carlson, that is my understanding, that at least for those areas dealing with early childhood and adolescence, that part of the annual planning process will include coordination with the Senate Bill 555 activities.
Okay. One more question, Mr. Chair. Losing track of my question here. Oh, I just lost it. I'll think of it. I'll get back to it.
The conference and health local health officials, which is the statutory body that represents local health departments and the health division, writes standards for public health work. The health division handles data and billing systems for targeted case management home visiting programs, and that's an attempt to do the most to maximize federal funds. The health division and the conference of local health officials write those program assurances that I was talking about, which in essence then is a contract that we have with them. Health division and local health departments have joint study projects, and hepatitis A, chlamydia work, foodborne diseases are just a few examples.
That's out of my question, Mr. Chair.
Let me go back to Representative Carlson.
Sorry. Well, it fits on this whole page. The Association of Oregon Counties has a high